G'day listeners, you are listening to the Natives Rouseabout podcast. I'm your host Trent, and today two of ANA's Sydney branch members will be joining me. Welcome Richard, how are you going?
Trent, thanks very much mate, it's great to be on. I'm well. I must say I'm a long time Natives Rouseabout listener and very happy to be here as a first time guest.
Awesome. All right, and we've also got Percy. So welcome, Percy. How are you going?
Good, thanks, mate. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right, great. And seeing as we've got our two Sydney siders on the microphone tonight, we're going to be discussing Sydney in a historical and cultural context, exploring why it's so important as part of the Australian nation's story. And we'll also hear a bit about the establishment of the Sydney branch and our two guests' journey into nativism. So we'll get stuck right into the episode. And as always, we start with some questions from listeners. So GT Avatar said, what is the song at the end of the video? So at the end of every episode, we put in a different song. So that one was a version of Ian Muddy's Australia Day that had been put to music. And I'm not sure where you can find the recording or if there's an artist that you can search, but if you go on YouTube and you search Nativist Mixtape 1788, you'll be able to find that song. It's called Australia Day, and you'll be able to find a bunch of stuff that's very similar. So that's a hot tip for anyone that enjoyed the outro song at the end of the last episode.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that song. I was actually driving back from work when I was listening, and I was playing drums on the steering wheel. It was great.
All right, that's good to hear. That's what we want our listeners doing. All right, and we have one more question. Koala Bear 499 commented, he said, can I suggest a target 90 to 10? Thus, non-native stock can automatically assume they're in the 10% and 90% stock population will be and remain culturally dominant. 90-10 fits nicely on merch and signs as well. Cheers, lads. All right, I'll start with my response to Koala Bear 499. Thanks for the comment, mate. I guess I wouldn't disagree with that target. How achievable that is, and like we're already way past that, so we would have to do a significant amount of work to get back to that ratio that you're describing. So I don't disagree, but the association is not in a position to dictate policies, and I guess I'm just not that into sloganeering. The focus of the association is ensuring the cultural preservation of our people in this land. But a good suggestion regardless. Any comments from you on that one, Richard?
Thanks, Trent. I generally agree with what you said there, mate. Yeah, sure thing. 90-10, probably, you know, if you slap that on caps and shirts and temporary tattoos that people can wear on their cheeks at Australia Day, then you'll probably sell a bit of merch. It is snappy, but there would be a lot of work to be done to achieve a ratio like that. I think an important conversation for the nation to have would be whatever the ratio is, 90-10, 80-20, or anything sort of different to what it is now, or its trajectory, or where we might be in 10 or 20 years' time. I think there's two important questions, and that is if someone's proposing a ratio, how are we going to get there practically and realistically? And even just as important, what do we do after we've met that target? I think they're two key questions that it would be helpful for Australians to start considering and for serious people to look at answering seriously.
All right, that's a very thoughtful response. Richard, what about you, Percy? Did you have anything to weigh in on that one?
I think it's interesting that a lot of people look back at the 1990s very optimistically and nostalgically in particular, as that 90-10 percentage does seem about right, particularly in the cities, even unless if you were in particular parts of the city where there had been large migrant influxes. It was very confident in the 1990s. It was a very confident Australian Anglo-Celtic belonging. There was also much more of an older generation as well too that were much more steadfast in their beliefs that were somewhat of an anchor, whereas we've really lost that anchor today that hasn't carried forth in, say, that the greatest generation's children, the baby boomers, who are more than happy, I think, to travel overseas and see the change. The difficulty would be how that's achieved, and that is something I suppose we'll have to wait and see how that's done, if it is at all done.
All right, thanks, Percy. Anyway, 90-10, it's a powerful rhetorical little snippet. Sort of reminds me of the remigration sort of motto that Steve Laws in the UK champions. But yeah, not to be a wet blanket on it, but yeah, that's all I'll say on that one. All right. So next thing we're going to do is we're going to have a poetry reading, and very fitting for this episode, the topic's going to be Sydney. We're going to have Sydney Side by Henry Lawson. Richard, do you want to do a reading of that one?
Yeah, sure thing. Where's the steward? Barroom steward, berth. Oh, any berth will do. I've left a 3-pound billet just to come along with you. Brighter shines the star of rovers on a world that's growing wide. But I think I'd give a kingdom for a glimpse of Sydney Side. Run of rocky shelves at sunrise with their base on ocean's bed, homes of Coogee, homes of Bondi, and the lighthouse on South Head. For in loneliness and hardship, and with just a touch of pride, has my heart been taught to whisper, you belong to Sydney Side. Oh, there never dawned a morning in the long and lonely days, but I thought I saw the ferries streaming out across the bays. And as fresh and fair in fancy did the picture rise again, as the sunrise flushed the city from Woollahra to Balmain, and the sunny water frothing round the liners black and red, and the coastal schooners working by the loom of Bradley's Head, and the whistles and the sirens that re-echo far and wide, or the life and light and beauty that belong to Sydney Side. And the dreary cloud line never veiled the end of one day more, but the city set in jewels rose before me from the shore. Round the sea world shine the beacons of 1,000 ports of call, but the harbour lights of Sydney are the grandest of them all. Toiling out beyond Coolgardie, heart and back and spirit broke, where the rover's star gleams redly in the desert by the soak, but says one mate to the other, brace your lip and do not fret, we will laugh on trains and buses, Sydney's in the same place yet. Working in the south in winter, to the waist in dripping fern, where the local spirit hungers for each saxpence that we earn. We can stand it for a season, for our world is growing wide, and they all are friends and strangers who belong to Sydney Side. The other siders, yet we wake the dusty dead. It is we that send the backward province 50 years ahead. We it is that trim Australia, making narrow country wide, yet we're always the other siders till we sail for Sydney Side.
Thanks, Richard. As a proud Queenslander, I'm tempted to say that I hate that, but it was actually very good. I really enjoyed that one. Very conjured the images of Sydney to my mind very, very strongly. Did you have any analysis on that one, Richard, that you wanted to share?
Yeah, sure. I'd say I'd start off by making a contrast between this poem and a lot of Henry Lawson's other poetry, which is quite romantic and glowing of the outback and his time spent there, because he was a Sydney Sider, and he was sent out into the outback and across the desert to Western Australia to work, and it would have been hot and sweaty and a long way from home. But I really love that in this poem it's a romantic ode to his hometown Sydney, and that resonates, and I'm sure it does for Percy too.
Yeah, Percy, do you want to share? I know you mentioned that there was some specific terminology used in this poem.
For sure. That was the first paragraph that really struck out for me, in particular, for in loneliness and hardship, and with just a touch of pride, has my heart been taught to whisper, you belong to Sydney Side. I do find there is something always very special about arriving in Sydney after you've been away. Being away from Sydney can cause one to feel loneliness and homesickness, particularly if you've been overseas. And it's always something of pride to say when people ask you Melbourne or Sydney and you respond Sydney, it just feels better. But in particular, even coming into Sydney by way of plane, you know, looking down and seeing the harbour and seeing the, you know, familiar streets and sights, but also when you're out of Sydney and you're travelling into Sydney on the road, crossing the Georges River if you're coming from the south, or the Nepean River if you're crossing the Blue Mountains into Sydney, or the Hawkesbury if you're coming on the M1 from the north, there's always a breathtaking sight as you cross those rivers, and a feeling of returning to Sydney. It's a very special feeling.
All right, so now that we've had our poetry reading, let's talk a little bit about the story of Sydney. Now, obviously, this isn't going to be an exhaustive history. That's beyond the scope of this podcast, but we're going to highlight some of the key moments in Sydney's history that shaped Australia. So how about we start with the arrival of the first fleet in Botany Bay. To one of my Sydney siders want to take it from there?
Yeah, sure. I'll kick off with that. The arrival of the first fleet in Botany Bay and then Sydney Cove, and that really was the birth of the Australian as we know him today. I guess what stands out about our early colonial story is that it was a real story of struggle and adventure, pioneering, establishing the basics, essentially. There was close to 1,500 people across 11 ships that made up the first fleet. They got very busy very quickly after arrival, starting to establish, you know, a first colony town. They had a very finite supply of food. There was a water source, what was later called the Tank Stream, but it was a natural creek that flowed into Sydney Cove. That supported them for a short period of time, but as the colony grew, the need to source more fresh water and keep that fresh water clean became a real struggle as well. And then, I guess by way of just overview, just the struggle to govern a people that have been sort of displaced from the Northern Hemisphere and thrown into a completely alien continent for them. And it was really a marvel of the time that they could set themselves up so quickly and actually not only survive, but then lead on to flourish.
Either of you familiar with the story of James Ruse? He was an emancipated convict in New South Wales, and he was given the first, what did they call it? Land grant. Sorry, looking for the right phrase. Yeah, given the first land grant in New South Wales because he successfully cultivated wheat. So the Governor Phillip was desperately wanting them to start producing their own food. And this convict was given leave, given a couple of acres of land on which to farm. And when he successfully farmed wheat and produced a crop, he was given 30 acres of land, that's like a good little microcosm of what was going on, and a good example of the rehabilitation of these convicts. I just wanted to drop that little bit of trivia on you.
It's often forgotten by, you know, a lot of the people that live there now, but Parramatta, you know, is definitely the source of our food bowl as a people. For anyone that either has First Fleet lineage or came very soon afterwards, we really do owe it to Western Sydney that grew so much of the food that we came dependent on. And with James Ruse, it's an inspiring story because this is an individual that went out to create food in Australia that had never happened before, where you had actual concentrated farm that was productive for a settlement to occur. It also meant as well too that we weren't reliant on ships arriving. And I think it's very important to remember that we really are reliant completely on ourselves and reliant on our fellow mates, because there really is no one that is coming to save us. So that, yes, James Ruse should be, you know, known by all Australians as really encouraging independence for Australians to stand on our own feet.
Absolutely. I mean, really that became the model for, you know, free colonists, pastoralists, using Parramatta as a launching pad to establish farms across the Hawkesbury. You know, once they'd made it over the mountains, the Western Plains, what we now know as the western suburbs, or much of the western suburbs of Sydney and the southwest, and then even sort of as we're branching out into Greater Sydney, those areas were established by those pastoralists that went out and grew crops that had never been grown on this continent before. Like the first settlers that arrived were predominantly Londoners, and a lot of them convicts. Probably a lot of them were labourers and backgrounds in labouring. There would be some craftsmen, but they weren't farmers. There was very little farming knowledge, but it was really a blessing that Governor Phillip had the maturity and the experience to understand that there was a gap, there was a knowledge gap there, and that needed to be solved, and sort of free enterprise was a part of that solution. I would say that has also been an early underpinning of the egalitarian sort of nature of the Australian and the Australian nation as well. Give any man an opportunity to use his hands and use his brain, and to look another man in the eye as an equal, and he will go out, he will start a farm, he will produce food for his family, his community. And that early, it didn't take very long, a matter of decades, I believe, before the Sydney colony in New South Wales was producing food for export. I mean, that's astounding.
Yes, very much so. All right, so we've covered the early settlement of Sydney. Do we want to move on and discuss Sydney's role in federation, the birth of Australia?
I would say that the New South Wales journey towards federation is one that was, you know, fraught with quite a bit of contradiction. We were obviously the first location of the arrival of the first fleet, and Sydney was the first city being established. But we were still very connected and reliant on trade, particularly with the empire. The industry that we had built up, we were reliant on trade. And this was somewhat contradictory to the experience that Melbourne had, that also was very big on manufacturing. So they were very interested in protection. So the difficulty that we had was that with federation, it did pose the issue for New South Wales, the question of what are we going to do about trade policies. For New South Welshmen, we were very interested in free trade, whereas Victorians were wishing for there to be protection. Sir Henry Parkes was really the father of federation in New South Wales, and really moved New South Welshmen with him towards federation. And if it wasn't for him, I don't know if New South Welshmen would have ultimately voted yes in the two, as I understand it, referendums for federation. And in Tenterfield, a beautiful town up north, in 1889, he said, "The great question is whether the time has not now arisen for the creation on this Australian continent for an Australian government and an Australian parliament. I believe the time has come." And from this, he worked very, very hard to get New South Welshmen across the line. There were a number of meetings that took place in both New South Wales and also Victoria to form the constitution of federation. There was also a lot of discussion that happened on the Hawkesbury as well too, on a boat, about drafting our constitution, which still lives to this day. But it did take our state a bit. We needed a second referendum to get us over the line, which we agreed to. In doing so, I think being difficult negotiators was to our benefit. We were lucky to have the first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, was a New South Welshman himself. So we were lucky in that sense. And the Commonwealth of Australia was declared on the 1st of January 1901, with the ceremony in Centennial Park, Sydney, a beautiful location for the founding of our federation. And during the ceremony, the first Governor-General, Lord Hopetoun, was sworn in, and our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, became Prime Minister. And as I understand it, he declared a nation for a continent and a continent for a nation. The event was widely attended, up to about 500,000 people. I've travelled all across Australia and from outside of the world as well too, many from different parts of the empire. And there was a federation parade as it went from the Domain to Centennial Park. And there were hundreds of thousands of spectators, which was, you know, quite momentous given that our nation's population at the time was under 4 million. It was a very special occasion for Australia and a time of much optimism.
Well, now that we've discussed Sydney's role in federation, I think we should move on and discuss a bit more about Sydney's evolution in the post-Federation period. Maybe you can run through some of the iconic landmarks in Sydney.
Well, I guess you don't have to be an Australian to know what the two major most iconic landmarks in Sydney are. You know, they're on postcards, they're on all out overseas advertising for tourism. They're what people often come to Sydney to see from all over the country. The first being Sydney Harbour Bridge, which was sort of termed the coat hanger as a bit of a slang term because it has that sort of big arch appearance that kind of looks a bit like a coat hanger. And I think that really speaks to Aussie humour. You know, you take something grand and awe-inspiring, and then you give it a slang term that makes it sound rather ordinary. So I kind of like the coat hanger. That bridge was opened in 1932. And just to talk a little bit about where it's positioned for people that may not be familiar with its actual location. So we've talked about Sydney Harbour, Sydney Cove. The southern end of the bridge is located at Dawes Point, which is in the Rocks area. Beautiful area of the Rocks, lovely sandstone buildings, a lot of history and Australian culture has risen from the rocks and still is. And then the northern end of the bridge is located at Milsons Point, which is on the lower north shore. Plans to build the bridge were first proposed by Governor Macquarie. That was as early as 1814. If you recall, it didn't actually open till 1932. So it was a very long conversation about a bridge that sort of took more than 100 years before we got one. It was a convict named Francis Greenway who really started that conversation, writing in his letter to the colony's newspaper and also petitioning to Governor Macquarie that Sydney needed a bridge, and it needed a bridge to connect the south to the north. And there's a quote there from that letter he wrote in the, what was it, the Australian newspaper, I think it was called. I could be wrong on that. He purported that the bridge would give an idea of strength and magnificence that would reflect credit and glory on all the colony and the mother country. And I think he was quite right about that, albeit, you know, 100 years premature. Percy, I know you being a big Lang fan, you might have some...
So this time 100 years ago, our Premier was Jack Lang. He was a man, a property developer himself, that particularly made a lot of money in the area that he lived in Auburn, in Western Sydney, which was rapidly urbanising it at that time. It was going from a previous farm use to starting to be quite a significant suburb. It was on the train line. There was also a number of factories in the area. So he was a property developer and doing quite well for himself, and then later moved into politics. There was a lot of politics that took place between the Nationalist government and the Labor government to get the Sydney Harbour Bridge done, largely because there was huge infrastructure spending that was required for it. They needed to not only build the bridge, but then also electrify the train lines and build the city circle to make it all work, to essentially connect Central Sydney Railway with the North Shore line. In Jack Lang's autobiography that was published in the mid-50s, he said that the Harbour Bridge, the city railway and the electrified railway system were built in spite of opposition from the Jeremiahs and the repeated cries that we could not afford them. Of course we couldn't then, but we still built them. Today they are great assets. Isn't it time to start planning for the future? Whatever our views, we must realise that this city is growing. Eventually it will reach the 5 million mark. Isn't it time we get busy with the next bridge? So it's interesting that writing that in 1956, he's already predicting that our population at some point will reach 5 million. Disappointing that, in his view, that growth would have come from natural population growth, predominantly from our people. We reached the 5 million mark in 2016. So it did take a bit of time, but a lot of that growth has come from immigration. But with Jack Lang, it was a momentous occasion for him opening the bridge. He was always a proponent of it and very much interested in building a lot of infrastructure. He had grand plans to knock down buildings in Sydney and build large promenades. But just before he was to cut the ribbon on the 19th of March 1932, a member of Eric Campbell's The New Guard, Francis de Groot, rode up and cut the ribbon just before Lang was about to cut the ribbon himself. Francis de Groot was taken away by the police and later released. But it was, you know, quite a bit of controversy at the time. So Lang was a nationalist. He was New South Wales First, but he did object to the plan that was being pushed by the federal government in particular to do what's called the Premier's Plan to drastically cut spending amidst the Great Depression. Now, the New Guard were ardent royalists. They were largely comprised of returned servicemen from the Great War, and they had concern. They had great fear about there being a societal collapse amidst the Depression. They did see Jack Lang with his grandiose spending and as well plans. At that time, he was starting to take money out of the banks and put that money into his own into the treasury in cash and requiring people to pay their taxes in cash rather than go through the banks. But there's also, too, a significant rise and interest in communism. So they were concerned from the perspective of the New Guard. They were very concerned of the rise of communism. And did see Lang in somewhat supportive of that or leading people to that, despite the fact that Lang was an ardent anti-communist. But keep in mind, 1932 for Australia was very, you know, tumultuous. You had the government of Joseph Scullin that collapsed, and that was done by Joseph Lyons leaving his own party, the ALP, and forming the United Australia Party. So he won the election in December of 1931 amidst the Great Depression, and he was the new Prime Minister of Australia and really was pushing the Premier's plan. So there was a lot of political turmoil at the time. And it later resulted, because of Lang's actions in taking the money out of the banks and putting that money in cash into the New South Wales Treasury, it did unfortunately culminate in the then Governor of New South Wales, Governor Gain, dismissing Lang from office later that year. But then conversely, you had Eric Campbell. So he was a returned serviceman. So unlike Lang, who was of Auburn in the western suburbs, Eric Campbell was a man that was living in Tarramurra. It still is very leafy today, but it was particularly leafy back in the day with a lot of quite large estates. That north shore of Sydney had a lot of citrus growing fruits, and then later on you had quite a lot of wealth come in as Sydney commercialised and a lot of very beautiful homes were built. So that's where he was from. So these men were on two opposite sides of the Harbour Bridge. But he did recount, it's very interesting in Eric Campbell's autobiography, The Rallying Point, which was released in 1965, so 10 years after Lang released his autobiography. Eric Campbell does recount the trip going back home on the 16th of February 1931 when he left the Imperial Services Club. So it's now known, that's now known as the Royal Automotive Club of Australia. It's very close to Circular Quay. But Eric Campbell recounted, the meeting then closed. My car, a 1929 model single-seater Studebaker 8 President, was parked at the curb outside the club. No parking problems then, and I drove home to Tarramurra via the 5 home by 1 p.m. And he goes on to say, I'm writing this 2 days short of 33 years after the meeting took place. During this period, there have been so many momentous changes in human affairs. So I find it very interesting that both Campbell and Lang, both strong adversaries in the early 1930s, found the opening of the Sydney Harbour Bridge a very significant event in their lives, and both men are really etched in the history of the Sydney Harbour Bridge. It not only changed their commute, but it did unite north and south of Sydney. And the event of the opening of the Harbour Bridge was extremely momentous. The estimates were that up to 750,000 Sydney-siders walked on the Sydney Harbour Bridge following its opening. And that's more than half of the population of Sydney. So this was, Sydney-siders were just in awe of this infrastructure project.
And as a bit of trivia also, the year that the bridge was opened, one of the most popular names for boys in Sydney was Archie, for the arch of the bridge, and Bridget for girls, apparently in honour of the bridge. So, you know, when you've got regular Australians, Sydney-siders, naming their children after a piece of infrastructure, I think that says a lot about what it meant, not just to the men that that Percy just discussed, but also just to regular Sydney siders.
Yeah. And for the listeners, if anyone is interested in what Percy was discussing around Newgard, Eric Campbell, Jack Lang, if you go back in the older episodes, Matt and Michael did an episode on The New Road, which was the political manifesto written by Eric Campbell, where they went into a bit of the ideology and a little bit of the history as well. So for anyone that's interested in that, you can dive back into the back catalogue. And I'll squeeze in a cheeky plug here as well. The anniversary of that event is coming up this month. So now would be a good time to be following ANA on social media, because we'll definitely be posting some pictures of this. There is pictures of Captain Francis de Groot riding in on his horse with his sword raised and getting dragged off afterwards. If you're following ANA on social media, Telegram and X and whatnot, then you won't miss them when they come out. All right, so we've spoken about the bridge, and let's talk a little bit about Sydney and the population of Sydney. Do you want to take that on, Richard?
Yeah, thanks, Trent. We did mention a little bit earlier the Sydney colony started with somewhere between 1,000 to 1,500 British colonists in 1788, mostly Londoners, and not too long, in the decades sort of following that arrival, population expansion, the population expanded, and that was mostly fueled by industry and opportunity, like the gold rush in the 1850s. Notably, that included a lot of attention and migration of up to about 50,000 Chinese migrants who came to work the mines. It was in 1911 that Sydney overtook Melbourne as the most populous city in Australia, when it reached about 650,000 people. Sydney passed the 1 million milestone by the early 1920s, and then there was a second population boom which occurred following World War II, and that, of course, there were two factors that drove that. First of all was immigration from predominantly or exclusively European countries. And then there was also a boom in native births. That was the rise of the baby boomer through the 50s. Going forward then a couple more decades into the 1970s, there were some very significant waves of immigration into Sydney. And this was following the abolition of the White Australia policy. So throughout the 70s and following the war in Vietnam, there was a large movement of Vietnamese people that moved into Sydney, as well as other cities in Australia. And then after the Lebanese Civil War, there was a lot of people from Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East that moved into Sydney through the 80s. Compared to the level of migration that we have today, those sort of migrant waves, I guess, were small in comparison, but they did have a very significant impact on local areas, because a lot of those migrants didn't sort of spread out and disperse evenly. They did congregate into suburbs or regions of the city, particularly in Western Sydney. Areas like Cabramatta has been known since the 70s as an area with a lot of Vietnamese migrants. Bankstown and Lakemba was where a lot of Lebanese settled when they migrated here. So as at 2025, the Sydney population is approximately at 5.5 million people. And what we've seen, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years, is a very dramatic change in the ethnic composition of our city. So I did have a look over some stats recently, and I've lived in Western Sydney my whole life. It's one of the most ethnically heterogeneous parts of the city. And even I was shocked to read that approximately 40% of the Sydney population on average, sort of averaged across all the regions, about 40% are overseas-born migrants and people. And the highest rate of overseas-born residents is, in fact, in Haymarket, in Sydney's inner suburbs, which is at 78% foreign 78% foreign-born. So think back to the 90-10 question from one of our listeners. We've almost got the opposite there. In for people that aren't very familiar with Sydney, or for our international listeners, Haymarket is sort of at the heart of Sydney's Chinatown. So it would be Chinese migrants that are sort of fueling that very tilted composition there.
I mean, ironically, Haymarket's always been known, even in my grandma's day in the 30s and 40s, as being Sydney's Chinatown. But it really was a case that, you know, once you left Haymarket, it went back to being all Australian, and the rest of Sydney was Australian as well too. There wasn't that stark suburb differences of different nationalities that Richard was explaining, for example, with Cabramatta being predominantly Vietnamese and Bankstown and La Kemba being known for being Lebanese. It was, despite we've always had Chinatown, but it's just very disappointing you find Sydney, it's become very much unrecognisable for many of us.
Absolutely. I would say as well, one of the stark differences, Chinatown's always, or for a very long time, predating our own lifespans, but Chinatown's always sort of had Chinese restaurants, Chinese shops and outlets, and there's always been a Chinese flavour there, being Chinatown. But what you used to see were Australians walking the streets of Chinatown, visiting the restaurants and so forth. But that looks very different now. You actually don't see very many white Australians walking the streets of Haymarket.
Sydney's definitely the direction and trends that I see with Sydney. It's becoming very much atomised based on nationality. Australians, unfortunately, we don't perhaps, even when talking to fellow Aussies, we don't perhaps explain why it is that we're interested in living in a particular suburb. But a lot of people will say, for example, that they ultimately want to live in a particular suburb, and you know the reason why. It's that they want to be around their own people. Obviously, it can be very difficult sometimes for people to be able to afford that. But people do talk in terms of euphemisms. Well, it's a good. There's good schools. There's good amenities. There's nice parks. It's a great location. But really, when you think about it, they're doing that because they are selecting on an ethnic basis where it is that they would like to live, and also too where it is that they would like their children to be around. Children that are the same as them, and the migrants are doing it as well too. This is done by everyone.
Absolutely, and we're seeing the effects of that play out in our political sphere as well. So, you know, block voting based on ethnic community trends is very common, and that's having a disproportionate impact on our elections, and that has an effect on the policies that the major parties put forward. So yeah, the effects of that are being felt across all spheres of our Australian society.
All right. Do we want to talk a bit about the millennial exodus?
I'm happy to lead that.
Yeah. Yes. Millennial exodus and some predictions for the future, please.
Yeah. Certainly. I'm happy. Thank you. So, being a millennial myself, growing up outside of Sydney, there was a lot of talk amongst my fellow peers that would we go and move to Sydney and start a career there, go to university and ultimately live. Sydney is obviously where it happens. It's still the commercial and cultural hub of the state. But since COVID, there was quite an exodus of both millennials and also two baby boomers that were leaving Sydney, but for different reasons. So the baby boomers were very much wanting to move out and have places to retire. The wealthy ones wanted holiday homes, somewhere that they could go in particular during the COVID lockdowns, get away from the plebs in Sydney and all the mess, and come to coastal regions or small towns where it was a lot quieter. And also too, there were some less restrictions during certain periods of time during COVID that a lot of the boomers, it did appeal to them. So there was huge demand from a lot of very wealthy people that were doing cash sales in small towns for that reason. But then also too, there was millennials that were leaving Sydney, and they of course weren't doing cash sales. They were generally either trying to get in with a rental property outside of Sydney, or they were doing it by way of mortgage. The destinations of where they've headed, the statistics say that a lot of millennials have left Sydney to go to Bathurst, Goulburn, Maitland, Newcastle, Tamworth, Gosford and Wagga Wagga. So these aren't places, for example, like Maria or Port Macquarie, where the baby boomers have headed to. These are traditional places that are somewhat working class and also have much more housing affordability for Sydney in comparison to prices in Sydney. So there's been rapid growth in these regional regional areas. I think that regional New South Wales is beautiful, but it is changing, somewhat similar to Sydney, and there is in regional New South Wales an awareness of that too. Of generally, people will think we don't want to become Sydney. That's why we don't live in Sydney. It is difficult for people that have moved outside of Sydney. If you weren't born outside of Sydney, it might be a little bit difficult. If you were moving into a regional town that has quite a sizable population, for example, it might be Newcastle or Wollongong, you're not going to have that problem. But if you're moving into a small town, people, if they ask you, will want to know what small town have you moved from. And if you say Sydney, they could be a little bit concerned. But if you throw yourself into some of the community groups and you know, get to know people at work, you'll really fit in. And it can be a wonderful place to go, you know, to raise a family. It's a lot more affordable. But again, conversely with that, Sydney is where it is happening. It's where the action's taking place. It's where the employment is. And it's also important too that, you know, we mustn't lose ground in Sydney, because even if you do move out of Sydney and you move into the regions, you will realise that we still very much are controlled by what takes place in Sydney, whether it be decisions about government policy or budget, all that kind of stuff. So it's very important, you know, that there still is an Anglo-Saxon presence or Australians in Sydney. That is vital. It's where we started as a people.
Yeah. Very, very true. So that was a bit of a survey of the current state of affairs. Do either of you have any predictions for the future? What's the future of Sydney hold?
My prediction for the future is that Australia is only going to continue to segregate itself into suburbs. So Sydney will become more and more, it already is, but it will just solidify that suburbs have an overwhelming flavour of particular nationalities. The big problem from a perspective of a white man, for example, is that you do feel that the suburbs are rapidly changing. So it might be, for example, that the Insular Peninsula in Sydney, the Northern Beaches, for example, that might be overwhelmingly Anglo-Saxon. But going back to my parents' generation in the 1980s, Chatswood was very Anglo-Saxon, and that is not the case. So there is a lot of insecurity from people that live in Sydney that their suburbs are going to inevitably change. I think that's going to be shown in politics. We're going to see if there is a growing awareness of Australians, for example, the rise of One Nation, if that continues. It may not be in its current form. It might evolve into something different. But if that awareness continues to grow, I think that electorally we're going to also see that. For example, in certain seats in New South Wales, it'll be very interesting to see what happens with Farah if that goes national to come in the by-election. The seat of Hunter as well too is probably going to be quite fertile ground for One Nation. So that's what we could find, very similar to the United States, where people have moved post-COVID, around COVID and after COVID, a lot of Americans decided to up and move to different states where they politically felt aligned. I think we're going to see that in Australia as well too. People will want to be with people that they have familiarity with, and politics is certainly one of those ones that people feel, well, you have my similar values. I would rather live here, rather live there than be stuck here with people that I really don't feel in common with.
All right. Richard, any predictions from you?
Well, I do agree with what Percy just put forward. I would say what concerns me about the future of Sydneysiders and of Australian people living, particularly younger people that are living in Sydney right now, when they partake in this exodus, when they move out of the city and into the regional areas or even into state, seeking affordable housing, work, or, you know, to be in a community that more resembles themselves, they're displacing themselves from their parents, and their parents will grow or already are growing old. They're moving away from the people that they went to school with and grew up and that they have history with. This problem that we have with housing affordability and the Brazilification of our city, this segregation into ethnic estates, is really pumping steroids into the atomization of our people, and I'm very concerned about that. And I do see that will continue to, that trend will continue to increase, and it will continue to have serious social implications for Australian people, because people benefit from being close to their families, and from moving from their teenage years into early adulthood and raising families amongst the people in the community that they have history with, and you lose that as soon as you leave your city. I was born in Western Sydney. I've always lived in Western Sydney. I've felt tempted on many occasions to remove myself from Sydney and establish myself somewhere else. But it's that connection to my city and the people that I share history with that holds me back from that. And I hope, I hope listeners that may be considering the same thing may give that due consideration before they make move out of Sydney. Think about what you're leaving behind that you'll never get back again. You can't go back to high school and spend that time with friends and the people you may have played sport with. I would urge people to think about that seriously.
All right, that's a perfect note to take us into our last topic of discussion. So we've just been speaking about concerns about atomization and the fact that there's really nowhere to run to. So why don't we move into the establishment of ANA's New Sydney branch, because that is our proposed solution to a lot of these problems. So why don't you guys talk about what you've been doing in Sydney and sell yourselves a bit to the listeners?
Thanks, Trent. Well, Sydney Branch incorporated mid last year. Last month, we held our 8th branch meeting and we celebrated New South Wales Day over a meal and beer, which was great. We discussed branch business and were treated to a talk from one of our members. He shared stories about his Australian ancestry and their important contributions to our nation. So why do men join our Sydney branch? Well, as we've discussed, Sydney is undergoing a radical change, and it's increasingly difficult for Australian men to share in our rich culture and interests with other like-minded Australian men. We really need to be intentional now in seeking each other out, and if we want to be effective in preserving our culture and way of life in Sydney, we just have to work together. So to give our listeners an impression of what it's like being a member of the ANA Sydney branch, here is a list of some of the things that we're up to. We seek to sharpen our minds as iron sharpens iron. We engage in discussions and debates about Australian history and politics. We share book readings. We have a few blokes that come together regularly for book club. We seek to develop our physical abilities in fitness and bushcraft. Some of our members recently attended an ANA Rangers meeting. They got themselves into the bush with other members from other branches. They enjoyed some camaraderie and camping together. We're planning projects for creating things of beauty, cultural significance, including literature, poetry, artifacts. And lastly, we want to support each other however we can. That includes networking for study and work opportunities, celebrating newborn babies, donating to help out young families. We really just try to give each other that moral support, and we try to take an active interest in each other's lives, and that's a part of the bonding experience. You know, we're doing in Australia what Australian men have always done. We're just doing it in a time where it's countercultural to the mainstream. Percy, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'd say that post-COVID, Sydney has been quite tumultuous with, you know, we've really seen a lot of very concerning incidences that have taken place, you know, just recounting them. For example, you know, in 2024, you know, in April, we had the Bondi stabbing, and then we also had the stabbing of Bishop Murray Emanuel. And then we also have the recent Bondi shooting on the 14th of December last year. So there's a lot of very concerning things that are happening in Sydney. We also geopolitically, we have the Iran war at the moment. I think that for Australia, this is going to be difficult with energy prices. So we're going to see a lot happen very soon and quite suddenly, very similar to COVID. You know, it was sort of slowly and then suddenly life changed dramatically, and that's what could happen here. I think for that, we need to collectivise. It's important for there to be that regrouping. I personally, myself, intellectually subscribe to the Strauss Howe theory of generational change, and everything that is happening right now is lining up with that very neatly. You know, there's group elevation. We're seeing the distinction between genders arise. It's why, for example, men really are struggling to understand women in a lot of ways. There's quite a distinction. And at some point, I think through this crisis, women are going to turn around and say to the men, look, we need you to fix this. Please go for it. Please fix this. And also, too, we're moving away from where individualism is promoted and rewarded, in particular financially, and also, too, from a vain point of view, but particularly financially, to where collectivization is required for survival. You know, if we do see fuel rationing and things like that, that is going to require us to work with our fellow Australians in terms of helping us get by. You know, my grandparents, and I'm sure, you know, for Trent and Richard, your grandparents too, they had a very strong consciousness of civic involvement and collectivization, whether that be in the church or community activities. And that is something that wasn't passed down by baby boomers. They baby boomers really grew up in a time where individualism was promoted. So they looked at those activities as being somewhat a bit, it just wasn't fashionable to engage in it, and you didn't need to engage in it. There wasn't any financial benefit. So we're rebuilding that collective effort. It's taking time. A lot of us perhaps don't know how to do it. We're starting from scratch. But this is the time. There's no better time than now to get involved in a time where we're going to need you're going to need to have contacts and be in the company of like-minded mates through this period.
Mm. Well said. All right, fellas, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about Sydney. I learned a lot. And for the listeners,
thanks, Trent. Been a pleasure.
The pleasure was all mine. For the listeners, let us know in the comments what topics you would like to hear about from us, or if there is a particular topic relating to Australia or the ANA that you would like us to do on the show. As always, I'd encourage all of our supporters in the audience to make sure you like and subscribe and share our content far and wide. We'd love to share our show with as many good Aussies as possible. Lastly, if you want to reach out, you can find us at oznatives.org. Thank you.
Farewell to old England forever. Farewell to my rum culls as well. Farewell to the well-known Old Bailey, where I used for to cut such a swell. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, ay. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. We're bound for Botany Bay. Tain't leaving old England we cares about. Tain't cause we misspells what we knows, but because we all light-fingered gentry hops about with a log on our toes. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, ay. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. We're bound for Botany Bay. Now the captain, as is our commander, the bosun and all the ship's crew, are the first and the second class passengers, knows what we poor convicts go through. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, ay. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. We're bound for Botany Bay. Oh, had I the wings of a turtle dove, I'd soar on my pinion so high, slap bang to the arms of my Polly love, and in her sweet presence I'd die. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, ay. Singing, Tooralai, oorralai, addity. We're bound for Botany Bay. So come all you young dukies and duchesses, take warning from what I've to say. Mind all is your own, as your tartar says, or you'll find us in Botany Bay singing Turalai, Uralai, Adity. Singing Turalai, Uralai, eh? Singing Turalai, Uralai, Adity. We're bound for Botany Bay singing Turalai, Uralai, Adity. Singing Turalai, Uralai, eh? Singing Turalai, Uralai, Adity. We're bound for Botany Bay.